Welcome to the Hackberry House of Chosun. My name is Bob, and reading today from The Scarlet Threads. We're in about the middle of part two, and I'd like to tell you everything we've done so far, but it just takes too much time each day. I do hope that you'll go back and look. We're talking now as we study the history of a mystery called Babylon through history, through the Old Testament, through the New Testament, now into church history. We're talking about the first real popes. Some want to say that Leo the First was the first pope. He reigned from 440 to 461. Halley said he claimed that he was, by divine appointment, primate of all the bishops, that resistance to his authority was a sure way to hell. He advocated the death penalty for heresy. Again, it's necessary to stop a minute. Early in this history, we see men taking it upon themselves to judge sin. How was it in the first church? Was there ever a death penalty? We say yes, in the case of Ananias and his wife. Both of them lied to the apostles and to the Holy Spirit in the apostles, and to the church. They were soundly cursed, but death came through the direct intervention of God, not by man. Later we see Paul delivering someone to Satan by the word of the Lord. That is, the offending brother was disfellowshipped. Later it would seem he was restored. In any case, God was given his needed time to do the work in the man. But the mongrel child of Rome and Christianity shows both of its roots in its handling of discipline through these dark years. There is the attempt to restore in many cases, and surely this is Christ. But upon failure to restore, excommunication, sometimes even this is Christ, then the unrepentant one is delivered to the secular arm, the military, the executioner. This is not Christ. Note here, as you're traveling with me through this dark, dark valley, the division between what is true, absolutely true, and what is almost true. That doesn't work. Let's move to 600 A.D. Another candidate for first real pope is Gregory the First. He reigned from 590 to 604. Now, you will, I hope, forgive the ambiguity of historians. The papacy slowly evolved. Snowballing through the history of the church, it picks up various elements on the way. Some see the finished product long before others, but all know where it is heading. Gregory does not claim jurisdiction over the growing eastern leg of the church, which is centered in Constantinople. The leader of that church, though, called Patriarch, that's a fancier word, which just means the same thing as Pope, it means father, he was calling himself the universal bishop. Gregory was a bit perturbed at such arrogance, calling the title vicious and haughty. Well, he will not wear such a title himself, but he certainly behaves as though it were his. And to call yourself father of the whole church to begin with is arrogant enough, right? But two things about this entry. Gregory himself, he's a good man. He's not as daring in his claims as future popes will be. And he's as pure and holy a man as ever sat on the chair. But be it known here that we do not decry the papacy because of its later immorality alone, but because of its origin. And that origin seems to be the planning room of Satan, who began his world domination by building the original Babylon. The papacy and its hierarchy are wrong because they were not given their commission by Jesus. It's necessary to understand this here, lest we are faced with the obvious argument about Protestants who have lapsed morally. Smear campaigns can be waged on either side. The fact remains that Jesus has initiated a fellowship, and Satan has initiated a world power. Now, I believe in a world power that's coming. Jesus is coming. I don't believe in dominion right now. We are simply given dominion over our own spirit and told to go over to that brother, over that person over there, and ask him to become a brother. We have been given a great commission. That's our job now. We don't rule the world now. Rome fell into that habit early and joined that same pathway that Satan was going along, and they've been doing that ever since. A quest for world power instead of a quest for godliness and a quest for discipleship and to build up the body of Christ. A second point concerning the Eastern Church. If Rome can be called the mother of all harlots, certainly her sister organization, now known as the Orthodox Church, could be called the aunt, A-U-N-T. A study of her history, which cannot be covered here, reveals that she's a close relative of Rome in more ways than one. Recall that for the first 500 years of the papacy, the two, though in conflict, were united. Only in 1054 does the inevitable separation, which is purely political, take place. But they remain one in kind, riding the backs of world powers to security, transforming the lowly faith of Jesus into secular dominion. The East practices most of the same inventions of the original, adding even more in the way of idolatry. She helps make Russia and Eastern Europe so bad that communism is a decided improvement that when it comes along much later, well, we don't love communism, but you would not have wanted to live under Orthodoxy or under Catholicism in its day. You wouldn't want that now either. We're moving right along. Let's talk about, in section 26 of my book here, Islam's relation to Babylon. Islam's relation. It's important that we stop again. I want you to walk with me down this side trail. This isn't the main trail, but come over here with me a minute. We're covering the story chronologically. It's necessary to examine the beginnings of another great religion, great in the sense of worldwide, to see if there is any connection between her, this new religion, and Babylon. It's hard to know exactly what to believe about the birth of the one that we've come to know as Muhammad. We know it happened in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, 6th century. It's said that miracles attended his birth and growth. Now, the reader, the listener, you are directed to the works of Sir John Glubb. It's a book called The Life and Times of Muhammad. And Martin Ling's Muhammad, His Life Based on the Earliest Sources. And I've written a couple of things about this too. Well, there's fairly strong evidence that there was a specific link between Muhammad and the Roman Church of his day. Augustine's work of bringing Arabs to Christ had been effective, though not totally so by any measurement. The tradition is that when Muhammad was 9, a Roman Catholic monk confirmed that he, Muhammad, was to be a prophet. That's tradition now. Later, more reliable sources add that one named Waraqa, his wife's Roman Catholic cousin, Muhammad's wife's Roman Catholic cousin, endorses and encourages Muhammad's visions. There's the connection. Thus, it is intimated that though Muhammad initially doubted, and this is fact, he doubted the validity of his supernatural occurrences, still various Roman influences in his life gave him assurance. Ah, thank you, Rome. And so the religion which now claims one out of every 5 or 6 people on earth, Islam, may have had at its very inception some nudges from the other religion that claims one out of every 5 or 6 people on earth. I consider it worthy of thought that had Muhammad not been encouraged by the growing apostasy of Rome, the faith we know of as Islam might never have happened. What if those Christians had brought Muhammad to Christ, rebuked the teachings that were contrary to the apostles, and stopped him before he even got started? Now, I will not belabor the point. We've got to believe in the providence of God and the plan of God in all of these things. But I'm just speculating. What if? Other advanced theories about his connections to Rome that are not necessarily borne out by documentation. But let me stop here. The main path beckons. We've got to return. Anyway, you can click on store here at Sermon Audio and find the works that I've done. In fact, we talked about them just recently. Just look through the books. You'll find two, one on Islam, one on Quran, and one on Muhammad, and one that combines both of those ideas. But we move on. Section 27. Let's see. Yeah, I think we can do that one last section today. 27 is the popes become earthly kings. We are at 700 A.D. now. And as we walk on, we see Papa becoming an earthly monarch by securing the help of other kings to do his bidding. For example, as a simple request, a Pepin, the Roman emperor in the 700s, Pepin, Pope Stephen of that day is able to gain mastery over the Lombards, who rule central Italy. And their land is given to the Pope, so he can have a domain of his own. This is the beginning of the papal states, or the, quote, temporal dominion of the popes. This is so foreign to the New Testament that some of you are having trouble dealing with it. I know there's nothing like this in the New Testament. Don't try to compare. Only in 1870 will this land finally be lost by the church. From 700 to almost 1900, this temporal dominion of the popes remained. We'll talk more about it as it comes up. Now in 800 AD, Leo III is the pope, and the great Charlemagne. These two, Leo III and Charlemagne, you've heard of him, they help each other's rise to power. You see how this works? One rides the other to power. You see in the book of Revelation, a woman riding the beast. That's what that's all about. One is supporting the other. That's how it happened here in the Middle Ages. That's how Rome, the system, the Roman Catholic system, became so powerful. It was being supported by the powers of the day. Charlemagne agrees that the papal states should remain papal. Okay, there is a conflict there. And in turn, Papa calls Charlemagne the Roman Emperor. Oh, they hadn't been called that for a while. So here was the beginnings of the Holy Roman Empire. You have heard that term. People have said this union was neither holy. It surely wasn't holy. Nor was it Roman, because it involved other places. It wasn't a true empire. Now, on the last two counts, I would have to differ a little bit, agreeing it was just far from holy. But Roman it was, having the seal of the man in Rome, who will always be pulling the strings. And an empire, yes, though pretty small for now. I see a woman riding a beast. Do you see that? I hope you do by this time. All right, we're going to stop right there and go to the book of the day. And by the way, you'll be happy to know, those of you who keep listening faithfully, and I appreciate you, this is just about finished. There's only one more after today. Look at this one. This is called Cries from Among Us. And actually the book title says Cries, from Among, capital U.S., us. I was trying to let people know that it's within the church, there is a cry reaching out, and people are saying, help, help. What it is, this is a look at the troubled teen homes of the Christian church. You can get it in Kindle for $1. Actually, zero after credit, so you can look at that yourself. The paperback is $15 because it's 343 pages, and I use their guidelines. I make almost nothing on these books. I hate to have to keep saying that, but it is the truth. Troubled teen homes. It rose up back in the 60s. It's an industry. You find some parents who are desperate to get rid of their kids, their teenagers. It can be young people, it can be different ages. This particular group that we were dealing with had started with adults. Can you imagine swatting adults as we do children with paddles? And well, we went through this whole thing and found some serious, serious problems. Most of these troubled teen homes have been shut down. And I know that those who were in charge of them are saying, that's the enemy coming against us. Not necessarily. This is a very confused issue. But there was ungodly discipline going on. There is a godly discipline. And it's very biblical discipline. But there's an ungodly discipline. You can take that thing too far. And if you're locked up with a bunch of kids, it's easy to take it too far. And some of them were in it for the money, some of them, whatever. There's different motivations. But I wrote a book about it, and I tracked this one group in particular, but we went on from there. I consider it a very interesting, helpful book. If you're a Kindle person, get it for a dollar. Okay, and that's the book for today. One more tomorrow, and then we'll stop doing this at the end of every lesson. But thank you so much for being here. That's all we have for this time. May God bless you. This is the Hackberry House of Chosun. Lord willing, we get to talk again real soon. Bye-bye.